Linden. I'll be appearing at the Carlisle Hotel on May 20th through the 24th. Right now I'm talking with Rabbi Saul Solomon on Dave's Gone By on UNC Radio.
Oh, shalom, shalom, everybody here in the neighborhood. This is me, Rabbi Saul Solomon, so excited and delighted to be talking to a Broadway star, a TV star, a cabaret star, now a musician and actor. His name is Harold Lipschitz. Wait, what? That doesn't ring a bell? Oh, perhaps I should use his stage name, Hal Linden, who was on Barney Miller on TV for all those years. He was a Tony winner for the Rothschilds on Broadway. He was done some other Broadway shows, lots of television, and now you can see him live and in the flesh from May 20th through the 24th at the Cafe Carlisle in the Carlisle Hotel, singing and playing his little clarinet there. So excited to be welcoming Hal Linden to the neighborhood. Shalom, Hal.
Shalom, sir. How are you?
I'm good. You know, I've got all sorts of medical issues, but I conquer them. How are you? You're not a young man anymore. How are you physically?
I'm ready to do the Carlisle. I better be in good shape physically.
That's right. Now, you've been working on this cabaret show for a couple of years, right?
A couple? How about 40?
Oh.
Well, 40. I started doing a cabaret show when I was in the Rothschilds, as a matter of fact. Requests came for my appearance, and I started putting together something that I could actually do in front of people. And so one version or another of that show is still extant and is now a full-blown cabaret show at the Carlisle Hotel. So I better be in good shape. It lasts about 75 to 90 minutes.
90? Whoa, that's longer than most cabaret things are, like 55 minutes, and they make you buy 5 drinks just to get out of there. But
you may have to buy 5 drinks. I really don't know.
Good Lord. Well, is there a theme, a title to the show, or is there a particular bent to what you're doing?
I'm eschewing titles. I don't really want to say titles.
Okay.
Evening with Hal Linden. However, there's always a theme. My main background, of course, is theater.
Yes.
So you can't just stand up on a stage and blather to people.
I can. I've done it.
I am there. It therefore has hopefully a beginning, a middle, and an end. Let's put it that way. And that's just from my theatrical experience. Everything I do, or I try to do, has a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Well, what's an example of a song that you were working on 40 years ago that's still in this cabaret piece, and the most recent song that you've included? Which you play the clarinet, by the way.
I play the clarinet. And the latest song I wrote was a new closer, I didn't write.
Oh, okay.
I rewrote a more modern version of I'm Still Here.
Oh, of course.
Which, you know, talks about survival and how a man of my age is still standing up on a stage and playing a clarinet and singing to people.
Well, can I ask, what are some lyrics that you may have revised for this? Because I don't know if you were around when Major Bowes was there. So what are new lyrics that you may have written for this folly song?
The original, I'm Still Here, first of all, is for a woman. It has female references. I wrote it for a man, me specifically. And the original is about a woman who grew up in the 20s and early 30s. Events in her life, they're not in mine. Mine are from the that, you know.
Okay, yeah, I was wondering what
to... That's the point of it, is to, my point was to bring it up to date, not only for me, but for people who are going to be listening to this. In the original Sondheim lyric, which is a terrific lyric, she mentions Brenda Fraser. I doubt very much that anybody remembers Brenda Fraser.
Not at all. I have no idea who that is.
Well, I remember too, okay. But that's not the point. I think most of my audience would remember Uncle Milty a lot.
Better than... So, is there a rhyme that you're particularly proud of? Because it's not just enough to update some names in there, but you have to keep the rhyme scheme going and make it clever.
Well, we've tasted the bitter, the sweet, the sour, from Roosevelt to Truman to Eisenhower.
Okay.
We're long past the flower of youth. It's abundantly clear. Still, we've contrived to survive, and we are still here.
Indeed.
Okay, thank you.
That's very nicely done.
I hope Sondheim is happy with it. I don't know.
Well, I hope you invite him. I hope he comes.
I hope he comes, too, but I doubt it.
Now, let's roll back the career of Hal Linden all the way back, because you talked about you starting as a musician, 60 years ago and stuff, but you went to the High School of the Performing Arts, the a.k.a. the Fame School.
The High School of Music and Art.
No, I'm sorry, it's different. High School of Music and Art.
Different in those days. In those days, the High School of Performing Arts was basically a vocational school. It was the school of, what was the movie?
Well, it wasn't Fame.
Fame.
Oh, it was the Fame School. Okay, yes, yes.
High School of Performing Arts. That was basically a vocational school. High School of Music and Art was one of the four top high schools in music in New York City, with Stuyvesant and Brooklyn Tech. What was the other one? I can't remember. I can't think of the other one. Where you had to pass tests to get in, you know, musical tests. And we still had scholastic program.
Oh, of course, yes. Well, yes.
A full high school program added to all the music and all the arts, so it was quite a, you had to really be up there. It has since merged with the High School of Performing Arts. It is still one of the top schools. It's now called the LaGuardia School.
Right, yes.
And functions very well, and it's very difficult to get into this day.
But was your entree into that school clarinet or singing, or what was your ticket through that curriculum?
No, I was a classically trained clarinet player, and one of the better ones in the school. So I really was eventually the top clarinet player in the school. Before I got there, there were quite a few good clarinet players, including the one who was the first clarinet with the Philharmonic for all these years, Stanley Drucker. So there were great clarinetists before me, but I went through purely as a musician. The interesting thing was I never set foot on the stage. I didn't sing. I sang with bands, but I didn't. I didn't sing classically, and I didn't appear in any of the high school plays or anything like that. Went through college, two colleges. Never set foot on the stage. I was purely a musician, and it was only by kind of chance that I ended up in the as an actor.
Well, what was the happenstance that made that transition?
Well, there were two happenstances. One was the fact that I was drafted.
Oh, well, yeah, that would do it.
And in the Army, I was a musician again. I was in a post band in Fort Belvoir, Virginia. And we had a piano player in the band who used to, first of all, I used to sing with the band. So whenever we played for the Officers Club or Service Club or any kind of dances or anything, I was a singer.
Okay.
That I did do. So it was a singing saxophone player, let's put it that way. And we had a piano player in the band who used to get borrowed by Special Services every time that they wanted to do a show. And this happened a few times, and then one time he just turned to me and said, "Listen, you want to sing a song on the show? I'll have him borrow you too." And I said, "Sure, why not? Give it a shot." And that was quite instrumental in my eventually becoming an actor, because what happened was they had some sketches where they needed
Now, did you ever go on to take maybe lessons or join Actors Studio
exactly
or
what
HP?
Happened,
what?
At that time, I had already graduated college. So I used my GI Bill when I got out and went to the American Theater Wing and started studying acting and went to dance classes and studied ballet and singing and everything, you know. One other thing that happened at the same time was that it was the absolute end of the big band era. When I went into the Army, there was Stan Kenton, Woody Herman, Billy May, Count Basie, Duke Ellington. I mean, there were tons of big bands. It was the height of the big band era, both musically and popularity-wise. And when I got out, they were all disbanded. It was over.
Disbanded, literally. The little playing words there, yeah.
It was over, and I was kind of forced into the choice of continuing my work with, you know, in theater, trying to make a career in theater, or just, you know, weddings and bar mitzvahs.
Well, that can people make a living doing that. I certainly make a living with bar mitzvahs.
But I think I was a little intrigued by the acting thing, and I made it my. For about 3 years, I did both. I studied, and I went off and did summer stock, and then I'd pick up the horn again and make a living. And
what was your first big break, Hal Linden? Was it getting that understudy job in Bells Are Ringing?
Bells Are Ringing as the understudy. And
unlike Sidney Chaplin, you could sing, so that was something.
Sidney was not bad.
He wasn't bad. He was
one of the most charming individuals you ever met, by the way. I knew Sidney relatively well. Charming, charming guy, and his charm showed on the stage. I spent a lot of time watching him try to be charming like him. I didn't have his innate charm. Yes, I think I sang better than Sidney, but that he was very good in that part. Anyway,
right.
Point is, once I got the role, once I got the part as the understudy and went on immediately and was elevated to standby and eventually took over the part when Sidney left, I made the conscious decision to put away the horn and not to work as a musician, but to concentrate on acting.
Well, actually, also, before we leave Bells Are Ringing, though, have to ask, do you have any memories, recollections of Judy Holliday?
The best memories. The most generous actress I think I've ever worked with.
Oh, my. In what way? How?
Well, she was the star of the show, obviously.
Sure.
And the story was about her relationship with maybe six or seven different people, all her clients on the answering service. And she actually delves into their lives, is the point of the story, of the story of Bells Are Ringing.
Yes.
Of course, she ends up, you know, in a romantic relationship with my character, but involved in all these characters. And every time they appeared on stage, she was fully aware that even though the story was about her, the more you established those other characters, the better she did. And she was so, she would turn her back to the audience to keep the focus on these other characters, including me. I remember doing Just in Time. Just in Time was done on a date going to a party, and in one down in the front of the stage, and it was just dance across the stage from stage left to stage right, in dancing position, and you're kind of singing, crooning in her ear. That's the way the song was staged, and that's what I did. I had never, of course, rehearsed with her when I went on the first time. I was the understudy, and, you know, she didn't come down to city rehearsals. And there I was. I took her in my arms, and I started dancing across the stage, singing in her ear. And I felt, to this day, I my back remembers that arm. She just twisted us in such a way. Understand, we didn't have microphones in our hair in those days. You had to sing out and be heard by the audience. And I was kind of crooning the song into a
Oh, very smart.
Across the stage, I was singing out.
So that they heard what you were singing and also could see a little of your face.
Right.
Yeah, very nice.
It just was an indication of the kind of, A, person she was, and B, actress she was, because she realized, I mean, she could be, you could stage it and so that you were always looking at her, but the story wouldn't be told as well. And she knew that and put herself in, as I say, with her back to the audience so that the attention would be on someone else. But of course, I was singing about her, so it was okay.
Well,
she recognized that. That's my point. I'm not, yes. You know, yes, she was a generous person as an individual, but as an actress, that's the kind of generosity that gives to others so that the whole is better than the sum of its parts. That's really what I'm saying.
Well, you get to see the whole Hal Lindgren, by the way. I'm going to remind people that you can see all the spotlight on you, front and center. You don't have to twist anything across the stage because you're going to be right there at the Cafe Carlyle from May 20th through the 24th. Do go see him. But another person that you only hear nice things about, and I'm hoping to hear nice things about from you, is that you worked on a 1970 revival of Three Men on a Horse with Jack Gilford. Do you have any Jack Gilford stories?
Jack Gilford, well, you got to put Jack Gilford in context.
Okay.
Jack Gilford was, of course, a victim of the blacklist in the 50s. He was a victim of the blacklist. And where other victims of the blacklist,
well, Zero Mostel was up there, and
Zero is one.
Dalton Trumbo, and I mean, writers and actors, of course, yes.
I remember one who wrote a book and was so bitter.
Dory Sherry?
Jack reacted with love. He was the most outgoing, loving human being, never a sign of bitterness, and considering what he had gone through, not a touch of bitterness, and just love. Now I'll give you one example of what he did in the show.
Three Men on a Horse, yes.
Three Men on a Horse, when he was playing the lead, and Sam Levine was in it. Sam was a different kind of guy. Sam had done the show since it was original, since he was the original. So he knew every word, and he knew, and he was kind of, he didn't think it was the best cast, you know. Maybe he had played it with the original people. He kept telling me who played my part originally. You know, I don't think he was too thrilled with me in the show, and he showed it.
Oh, not nice. Okay.
Showed it. Yes, he showed it. I remember being on stage, and I said my line to him. Maybe I inverted a word or two. You know, maybe it wasn't exactly the way it was written. Maybe it was paraphrased. I don't really recall what I did so terrible on stage, but he looked at me and played the rest of the scene staring at me with these glaring eyes as if I had done something terrible.
Huh.
Jack was on stage at the same time, and Jack saw this, and the next scene was between Jack, or the next section was between Jack and Sam, and Jack stood up and looked at Sam with the same glare, saying to him, "What are you doing? Why are you doing this thing? You know, how dare you treat a fellow actor this way?" Even though the scene was not about any of that.
Right.
I don't remember what the scene was about, but it became about this relationship. Jack just could not stand the idea of someone being nasty to somebody. He was just... there wasn't a nasty bone in his body.
That is what you hear about Jack Gilford all the time. Wonderful. Oh, wonderful stories here from the great Hal Lindgren. I have to ask another person that you worked with, a great entertainer, one of the great entertainers of the whole 20th century. You were a cast replacement in this musical called Wildcat. I assume that you worked with Lucille Ball.
Yes, of course. Oh,
and?
My Lord, yes. Well, I knew Lucy.
Oh.
Lucy had come to see me in... bells are ringing when we played Los Angeles. We went out after her. She took us out to the late night bite. And so I met with her. We talked about possibly doing something for Desi Lu. So I really, you know, and we stayed in California after that.
would change.
In any case, I knew Lucy very well. So it was kind of old times when I got into the show and to work with her. Lucille Ball was probably the greatest female comedian or comedic actress that I've ever seen. She was,
Well, were you able to learn anything from watching her on stage?
On stage, Lucy didn't have that much experience on stage.
Mm.
So she was kind of more dependent on us than we were on her.
All right, so let's flip that back. What about seeing her on TV or watching her at Desilu? Did you learn from her there something that was helpful to you later on TV when you were doing a bunch of TV?
Well, you know, I remember watching Lucy as a before I was in the business. You learn just watch her and you'll see a comedic actress. And you know something? Watch her movies, her early movies. Even before the I Love Lucy show, her taste and tact was just, superb in those early movies that she did, where she was, foils for other actors. She was terrific, even then. So, yes, there's a lot to be learned from Lucy. Just watch her timing. Sit and watch the I Love Lucy every episode, and you get a lesson in comedic acting.
Now, you just mentioned that there was this point when you said, it's not going to work out at Desilu, I'm not going to stay in California, I'm going to go to New York, concentrate on theater, did a lot of theater, and yet somewhere in the middle of the 1970s, I guess you made a decision to go back to the West Coast. What happened?
I didn't make that decision. Oh. The West Coast came to me. Danny Arnold was in New York City,
pretty easy bit of convincing there. Show, can you say what show that was?
A Broadway show, let's leave it at that.
Okay. I mean, did it eventually get on with someone else, or did it fall apart?
Yes, it eventually got with somebody else. It was not very successful.
Ah.
But the point was, at that point, I had to make a decision. That was the major decision, to stay on Broadway or to go to... Because I was really growing on Broadway. I had done Apple Tree, I had done Three Men and a Horse, I had done...
Well, you won the Tony for the Rothschilds.
And slowly but surely making a reputation, and then finally the Rothschilds. So I really wanted, was I going to stay? Then I did Pajama Games. So I was doing show after show after show, and it was a question of leaving Broadway to go to California. That was the big decision I had to make. Not so much, but the point is, once I decided to try
so it felt live-ish.
So that I would have, I thought, well, I have an advantage there. I've been working in front of audiences all my life, you know. It turned out to be the opposite. It's very interesting. We eventually did the show with no audience, and I appreciated that more than having an audience. I eventually found the audience in a sitcom distracting, pulls the show the wrong way, you know.
And you have to play things very big, even though it's...
Play things a little... Well, not so much the regulars, because we know who we are, but the those people who come in, you know, just for a week, the guest actors, they know they have to get that big laugh. And so there's a tendency to overplay, and particularly for a show like Barney, which had a kind of a reality, was really reality-based. I guess if you do the shows that are less reality-based, it really doesn't matter, and maybe an audience can help. But to watch a show that's about the stuff of life, you want to be a little more subtle about it, and it's hard to do in front of an audience.
So eventually they used a little laugh track, but you were really...
Well, they always... Everybody uses a laugh track. You have to use a laugh track, because you don't... It's not done straight through. It's done in pieces. You do reshoots of scenes, and changes of lines. I mean, all kinds of things go on when you do it, and it's eventually cut together, and they use a laugh track to even it out anyway. So it doesn't matter. They use a laugh track anyway.
Do you have a favorite Barney Miller episode?
I have a few favorites. One of which was certainly, I directed a couple of episodes, and certainly one of my favorites was one of those I directed. When you direct, you're involved in everybody's story.
True.
And it was just a wonderful experience in finding humor in what seemed like a not humorous scene, just a conversation between two people, which turned hysterical by proper direction, I guess, by what I said to the actors and what I gave them as background for that scene. It turned into a hysterical scene, even though there were no jokes in the scene.
That's the best kind of thing, yes.
Yeah, and so that's one of my favorites. I don't remember the name of it. And of course, I guess the quintessential Barney Miller is the hash brownie episode, which everybody except me dines on hash brownies that Wojo brought in, and everybody gets looped, and except me. I had to be straight as an arrow, now, you know.
Well, because that's the funny part. They have to have a straight person to play off. If everybody's goofy, it's not so funny. There's got to be that person reacting like the stone wall.
Straight person. 8 years of being the straight person.
And by the way, what was it, 7 Emmy Award nominations year after year after year after year?
But it only won in the last year.
Okay. And you were nominated every year. You yourself.
I was nominated many years, I think. Seven. I never won it for Barney, though. I won it for 3 other things, but never Barney. But kind of another story, because the point is that Barney Miller was an independent production. When you have an independent production, you only have a few people working on it. When you're doing a show at 20th Century Fox, the whole studio votes for you.
So I see.
Barney won very few Emmys, I think 4 in 8 years, and that's because it was independent. It didn't have a whole bunch of people working on it who were voting for you.
It was a quality show, and also it probably felt, even though it was on the West Coast, it felt New York-y, and there was probably a bias against it.
I tried to talk to Annie into shooting in New York. I said, we got all those New York actors, you got New York locations.
Yeah.
And Danny said, no, I don't want to move. I live here.
But you had to move.
He's a New Yorker himself, but I don't think he liked New York. So we stayed in California and did it in the studio, that's all.
Now, I'm sure the listeners want to know, have you been over the years in touch with any of the alumni of Bonnie Miller, the Max Gale, the...
Yes, I see Max quite often. Max and I now audition for the same parts.
Okay. So,
and the fascinating part, the last audition I went to, I actually auditioned against Ron Glass, who's got enough gray in his hair to audition for the same parts.
Oh, my goodness.
But we see each other then. A lot of the... a lot of that terrific cast, probably. You know, that's one of the...
What?
You talked about the Emmys. That was possibly the greatest ensemble cast ever assembled. It would rank with your great ensemble companies in television. And not one actor ever received an award, ever received an Emmy award. Because of that kind of situation that we were in.
The late Jack Sue, yes.
The late Jack Sue, who died while we were shooting, wasn't awarded. I don't think he was nominated. The year that he died, one would think at least that. But so,
and we did lose.
My point is, I was tremendously lucky to play straight for possibly the best ensemble acting company in television history.
It's an absolutely wonderful team, and it's a shame that we've lost already Steve Landisberg and Ron Carey. We have not yet lost Abe Vigoda. Have you been in touch with him at all?
I was at his 90th birthday, and he was still Abe. He was still out there with that energy. I don't know how he is now. I haven't seen him in a couple of years. He's about 92 or 3 now.
Right, but thank God he's still alive. So.
Yes, as far as I know, he's still kicking. He lives, I believe, with his daughter in
All right.
Yeah.
Now, Hal Linden is still very much alive and kicking and playing and singing and a little dancing. You can see him doing all of that at the Cafe Carlisle from May 20th through the 24th. Absolutely worth seeing. So much energy. Like 75 to 90 minute show he's up there doing. Do you have a couple of more minutes, Mr. Linden? Do you have to run? Oh, great. Wonderful. Because a little bit on the personal side of things here, that very sadly, we're talking about living and dying and things like that. Your wife of more than 50 years passed away a couple of years ago.
Right.
How do you get through that and go on?
Well, that may be one of the reasons I'm out there kicking. I just want to keep going and going and going. There's no point in retiring to sit home and watch television and play golf. So I'm out there, and I intend to keep going as long as I can. We just came back. We just finished a tour with this show that I'm doing at the Carlisle. Did 60 concerts.
Oh, my God.
Over about 6.5 months. And I was quite honestly a little apprehensive when I saw the schedule. Not the whole 6 months. We did 5 weeks, and then 2 weeks, and then 3 weeks, and then five, something like that. And got in 60 concerts, drove about 20,000 miles, and flew another 20,000 to accomplish it. And I was quite apprehensive. I said, I don't know, I'm not a kid anymore. Is it going to be a little tough? And I got stronger as it went on.
Oh.
I just reveled in the doing. Reveled in the doing. And I think it made me stronger as I went on. Hopefully I'll be up for the Carlisle.
Do you take voice lessons? Do you practice? Do you go to movement classes or anything? Or you just do what you do?
I try to stay in shape. I'm in the gym at home just about every day. On the road, we try to, work out at least 3-4 times a week just to keep the energy level, keep in shape. I sing enough to keep it going. When there are times when I lie fallow for a while, I'll go to the piano and vocalize to keep the chops up. As far as the clarinet is concerned, when I'm not playing it in my show, I have a place in La Quinta, in the desert, LA, and there's a jazz band there that I play with kind of regularly.
Oh.
Keep that going. And so I don't sit home and do scales. No, I'm not. I don't have that kind of discipline. But I do. I keep it up.
That's wonderful. That's one of the things. And speaking of something new that's old and also new, there's a revival of a revival currently on Broadway. They brought Cabaret back. Not just Cabaret the show, but the Cabaret that they did 15 years ago,
right,
with Alan Cumming and the Sam Mendes production, which you were in for a bit. Do you have any...
I played about, I did almost a year then.
Yeah, so any thoughts on, I don't know if Natasha Richardson was still in there at that point, or Alan Cumming, or the people you were working with, or that particular production of the show?
I did it with John Stamos playing
the MC. Okay.
He was terrific. Jane Leaves from Frasier did the female lead, Sally.
Uh-huh.
It was a terrific cast. I'm blanking on names. I'm terrible.
Well, it was a long run and well into the run, so it wasn't the original people, but was it a little, because it's a very unusual kind of revival. It's very dark, it's very... expressionistic in some ways.
Yes.
Did you have any thoughts on it?
Very. When you think of Weimar Republic, Germany, you think of that kind of expressionistic period that art went through. Well, they copied that and brought it into the 30s. Sam Mendes did. It was quite an interesting, and of course the use of the actors playing the music was fascinating. The band was...
Oh, that's right.
Of course. Yeah, very interesting. Interesting revival.
Do you see yourself doing Broadway again? Is that a possibility if the role came along?
You got a script?
Actually, well, I kind of do. But we'll talk. So you would. So you absolutely...
Of course I would. I don't know how many major... Certainly not... I don't think there are that many musicals for... people my age anymore, you know. So that might be...
Well, it could be a play.
But there's a, you know, the attention of the occasional play. Oh, I'd love to do Broadway again, of course.
I mean, Cicely Tyson...
I have done two or three plays, you know, not on Broadway since. Actually, I did the... wait a minute. I beg your pardon. Just last year, I did the Scottsboro Boys in L.A. and San Francisco. So...
That's right, you would be just right for that, the John Cullum role.
Right,
Wow, oh, very good. And I know that the last show that Dave saw you in on Broadway, you did it was a short run. The show had some problems, but something called The Gathering.
Oh, yeah.
And Dave was excited about that only because he was a friend of Sam Gunstler, who was one of the actors in there. So just wanted to throw that name in.
An interesting attempt. An interesting... You know... how you pick what you do very often defines your career. I once gave an award. I was just the presenter of an award to, what was her name? Oh, God, here I go with names again. She did Doubt on Broadway. I can't remember her name.
Oh, gosh, Doubt. Oh, Cherry Jones. No, who did Doubt? It was Cherry Jones on Broadway.
No, it wasn't Cherry. I can't think of a name, but I gave her the award, and I had her bio in front of me, and as I was giving her the award, I remarked to the audience, I said, this girl has been in two Pulitzer Prize winning plays. Two!
Right.
You're right on to be in one, but to be in two. She really knows how to read a script and how to pick the parts that she wants to play. A talent which has eluded me in my entire life, because most of the things I've ever done, like occasion, you know, few, not hits, but well-received plays, but I have a bevy of bombs in my past.
Wow.
And one of the reasons is, I think, is because I choose the role rather than the play. That is, if I see a role that intrigues me, that makes me want to work on it, makes me want to delve into it, makes me want to be it, comedies that get nice reviews or bad reviews, but I've made a career out of it.
Well, also,
and unfortunately, The Gathering is one of those. Although I'll tell you this, I love it when people, say, "Gee, I loved you in The Gathering," a bomb or a flop that I had 15 years ago, because I put the same energy and imagination and talent, sweat, into that part that I did into the ones that worked. So, I remember those parts fondly, even though they didn't last very long.
Well, that's good, but it also begs the case of, were you ever either typecast as, or did you ever have to fight against typecasting, since your original name was Lipschitz? Do you ever just roll with the idea that, I'm going to get Jewish roles, or I'm going to pick Jewy sort of roles?
No, I don't pick them. I get offered them quite a bit, although I never did Fiddler on the Roof. No, I never did it. Yes and no. Yes and no. Barney Miller did that for a while, where I was off, the next four projects were police captains or, Hollywood tends to do that. Broadway doesn't that much. Although since the Rothschilds, I was, after that, I was offered many Jewish roles and played many, many Jewish roles.
And as you said, you won the Emmy for that, where you played a rabbi.
That's right.
Did you study? Did you have to do anything special to play a rabbi on TV? I know I have.
that property was self-explanatory, and it was more about anti-Semitism than it was about any rabbinical things he did. So that property was pretty much self-explanatory.
Well, it has.
I've seen a lot of rabbis at work, so I had a lifetime of research on being a rabbi.
And you saw them at your bar mitzvah, so yeah, you.
That's right.
You
I've
had
seen
them
rabbis.
Around. Are you at all?
I once emulated a rabbi that I remember from my childhood.
Oh, really?
When I did a part in The Education of Hyman Kaplan, I was a very small part. I played more or less the villain, I guess, the man that the leading lady was promised to, and that's the reason she couldn't be with the leading, with Tom Bosley, who played Hyman Kaplan.
Yeah.
So I didn't come in till the first act curtain was my entrance. That's how small a part it was, and I was out of the thing after one or two scenes in the second act. But the interesting thing was the character was, at one point, and the backstory was that he was on his way to America to marry the leading lady, but he was stuck in England. Either he was, at one point he was in jail in England, I don't recall the whole thing, but he was stuck in England, so I figured he learned how to speak English in England.
Oh.
And I had a rabbi once who must have learned English in England, and he spoke with a combination where the vowels were British, but the consonants were Yiddish. And so it was a kind of half Yiddish, half British accent. And I picked that one out of my memory and assigned it to that character. It was a wonderful character.
And see, a rabbi made this happen. Well, this rabbi is so glad that I was able to make happen this interview with the wonderful, the delightful, the incredibly talented Hal Linden, who I will remind one more time is going to be at the Cafe Carlisle this coming week, May 20th through the 24th. Go, run, get a sleigh if you need to. Get your tickets to see Hal Linden. Last question for you,
let me think while you're talking about it.
Yes.
I am also the national spokesman for the Jewish National Fund.
How long have you been doing this?
Oh, about 15 years now.
Mit Mazel, mit Glück.
I appear for the Jewish National Fund. If you call the Jewish National Fund, I answer the phone.
You are busy, my goodness.
My point is that in June of this
this one of those Aliyah things where if your children are under 21, they can go for free, sort of? Is that different?
Well, that's a different program. This is just a mission, a 10-day trip to Israel with myself and a few other JNF people. And it's a JNF-sponsored tour.
Well, you know, just since you mentioned that, I'm going to give you a moment to tell people just what the JNF is and does. I mean, it raises funds for dot, dot, dot.
JNF was the original collection agency, if you will, that raised all the nickels and quarters from those little blue boxes.
Yes!
Was in everybody's house.
The Pishka, yes!
The Pishka or the Pushka, depending on your...
I'm a Litbach and a Glitz.
Okay.
Kind of a, yeah, okay.
Then for me, it's a Pishka, too. In any case, the point was, that was in 1901, when the money was raised to purchase the land of Israel because of the Zionist Congress that had come to the decision that there should be a land of Israel. They created the Jewish National Fund. Nickels, quarters, a few million dollars from the Rothschilds.
That helps.
And the money went to purchase the land of Israel. The UN decision to recognize Israel and partition it. That partition was based on JNF maps telling where the land which was owned by the JNF was, and that's why the petition is where it is.
God bless them.
Boats,
God, yes. But
trees, certainly, you know all about trees. The JNF planted all those trees in Israel. That makes it a green country, and the next one is brown.
The
accumulation of water to keep the country green, all of that is JNF, all done by JNF. It's not a political organization. There's no political ties. It's purely... a fundraising organization to support all the ecological...
the beauty, the growth, the
growth
nature of Israel.
Of the state itself. It doesn't invest in companies. It doesn't invest in business. It's just to develop the state itself. So whatever shape the country is in, you can thank JNF for all these years.
And thank you for...
raising more funds by going to... by a mission to Israel in July. And if anybody would like to come... I think there's still some room.
I mean, even moving away from politics, it's just so nice to talk to a Zionist who isn't, like, apologizing, who isn't saying, oh, the poor Palestinians, boo-hoo, boo-hoo. It's like, no, it's our country. We love it. We're caring for it. We're making it grow. That's what it's all about, or at least in my personal opinion.
I don't want to get into the politics of it either. You know, everybody has a point of view, and everybody's got a horse in the race.
I always say we should move the Palestinians to New Jersey.
If you believe that Israel has to exist, and that is my most, after the life, what we've seen in our lifetime, we know that Israel must exist, and that's why I'm involved with making it exist as well as possible.
Helen, and if you could see me right now, I am levitating from my chair with kvelling and thrilled. To hear you say these things. I'm even going to push the Carlisle thing one more time. May 20th through the 24th, Hal Linden, and he'll have a blue box on stage. You can drop your dollar bills in for the JNF. Mr. Linden, my last question for you, and thank you for taking so much time with us. It's just been such a joy. Do you have a dream role that one day you hope will play or could play?
I'm not a kid anymore, and there are no dream roles that I could play anymore. That's the truth of it.
Well, King Lear, wait a minute. You know, a lot of people...
I know, King Lear. I played with King Lear over the years. I was going to do it, and I started studying it, and I never broke it. I never, never came to terms with it, so I never did it. Listen, it was said of me, when I'm not near the role I love or the show I love the show I'm near. And that's the story of it. there for 75 to 90 minutes every night and communicate with an audience one-on-one. And the doing of it is what makes it worthwhile. That's my reward.
Well,
so I'm just going to keep doing it until they won't let me do it anymore.
Until you're 120, until you're 240, double 120 for you, Hal Linden. God bless you. Thank you so, so much. Have a wonderful engagement at the Carlisle. Much success getting back to Broadway and with everything you want to do in your life. Shalom to you.